This is KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. In August of 1982, the USS Ohio entered the Puget Sound. It was the first of a new class of submarines intended to carry the Trident missile. The Ohio's home was to be the newly expanded Bangor Naval Base on the Kitsap Peninsula. At the entrance to the base, the Ohio met a blockade of several small boats. The peace blockade was the most dramatic of several dozen direct action protests at the base since it had been designated as the future home of the Trident submarine in 1973. The protest was organized by members of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, a small community of anti-nuclear activists living on the peninsula. In August of 2019, I visited the home of the Ground Zero Center in Poulsbo to attend the Buddhist ground purification ceremony for a soon-to-be-built peace pagoda at the center that borders the Trident base. The ceremony was chanted and led by the monks and nuns of the Nipponzan Myo-Oji Dojo of Bainbridge Island. It was there that I met two extraordinary individuals. Jim Douglas had been a former theology professor who, along with his wife Shelley, became longtime anti-war and civil rights activists. They were part of a group of activists in the Northwest that formed the Pacific Life Community in 1975, and two of the founders of Ground Zero. I also met Gilberto Perez, who grew up a streetwise kid in Spanish Harlem and then trusted the paths that opened to him as he traveled across the country during our nation's turbulent times of the 60s and 70s. Eventually, Gilberto became a monk of the Nipponzan Myo-Oji Dojo on Bainbridge Island. These are their stories. And now, let's go inside the compass.
My name is Jim Douglas. I am living now in Birmingham, Alabama, with my wife Shelley. In 1977, with other friends, we were co-founders of Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action.
And for those listeners out there that are not familiar with Ground Zero, what is Ground Zero?
The original Ground Zero is where the atomic bomb exploded over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and then directly beneath it, hundreds of thousands of people were killed, most of them civilian people. Ground Zero here is a center for nonviolent action right alongside the fence of a base with nuclear weapons that make the bombs that totally destroyed the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki tiny, tiny instruments by comparison. Right here we're talking about bombs which on one single Trident submarine can exterminate humanity.
You were instrumental in getting this property established and developed. What were the bumps along the road?
Well, the bumps along the road were our fear of taking the initial steps. Those were the main bumps along the road. Once we took those initial steps of finding this place, one day, driving by with a friend in a car and saying, let's check that out, this place, and see if it might be for sale. It didn't have a for sale sign on it. People next door said, yeah, it is for sale, and we contacted them, and a lot of people volunteered with resources, and we were able to purchase it. And as the local newspaper said in a headline, they now have a piece of the rock. They meant people who believed in a different world than one annihilated by nuclear weapons. People before us, long before us in fact, had been resisting the Vietnam War and had done so in the same fashion that we would carry on at Ground Zero. And by the way, one of those people is at the heart of Ground Zero right now. So the links are profound. And today in the ceremony here for the groundbreaking and the blessing of the land for the peace pagoda, was especially with Gandhi. And Guruji, the founder of the Nipponzan Myohoji Buddhist order, which is building the Peace Pagoda, Gandhi and Guruji, the founder of that order, were together in Gandhi's ashram. And today, at this ceremony, were people from that ashram. They were sitting out there, and I was just talking with them before talking with you. They played with Gandhi. They swam with him. And here they are at Ground Zero. I mean, that's a very concrete link, but the spirituality, the power of nonviolence, which lies at the heart of the universe, it's far, far, far more powerful than anything on this base, which can distinguish the life of humanity. That's the power we draw on at Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action.
And you're not living here now.
Shelley and I live in Birmingham, Alabama. We have there a Catholic worker, a house of hospitality for homeless people. We've been doing that for 25 years. We're still doing it. I write books. We go on peace and justice missions, whether it be to Palestine and Israel or Iraq or Bosnia. We go on these ways of nonviolence and try to stand between people who are maybe not understanding each other well enough to not go to war. So you try to stand in the way. And we can learn from everything going on in other parts of the world, and also in the Indigenous Peoples Movement right here. Standing Rock, hey, what an inspiration.
Long journey from the time that you drove down the road and said, I wonder if this place is for sale.
Short journey, 39 years. Time is of consequence, but time changes to the extent that we live fully in the time we're in the process of becoming.
How was your heart today when the ceremony took place and the chanting took place and the recognition of the reality that the pagoda was going to be built?
Well, just to look around and to see people that we've known that have been doing that for 39 years now in terms of doing all the things that build a peace pagoda until it can be realized physically, it's sort of like, well, it's good to be home again in many, many senses. And that includes people on both sides of the fence. It includes people who were involved profoundly, and many of them still are, on the Trident side. The story of Ground Zero begins with the man in Lockheed Missiles and Space Corporation named Robert Aldrich, who resigned his job at the age of 49 with 9 children, whom we knew. That's the inspiration for the founding of Ground Zero. It didn't come from the peace movement. It came from the designer of the Trident missile, who walked off his job with his 9 children, and they decided as a family, not a nuclear family, cross off nuclear, as a family seen in terms of the human family. Because they had that courage, we have now Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. It was a spiritual chain reaction from the Aldrich family, whom we met in Honolulu, Hawaii, when I was charged with crimes against the United States government that would have taken me to jail for 10 years, possibly. They came over, Robert Aldrich and Janet Aldrich, his wife, they came over, they supported us, and at a symposium where we were talking about international law and we were trying to obey international law in the nonviolent direct action we took to stop the Vietnam War in that instance, the air war killing literally millions of people, Bob Aldrich, whom we did not know was a designer of the Trident missile, he in the symposium, after hearing international law experts who came from Nuremberg. These were experts from the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. They were prosecutors, U.S. prosecutors. They testified they worked on our behalf. And Bob Aldrich is connecting what he's doing as a Trident missile designer with what they're saying. And when he came to the microphone at this symposium, he froze. We thought it was because he's a very shy man, which he is, a very modest man. He told us a year later, after he'd resigned his job, he saw himself as a war criminal. That's the kind of person that anybody on the Trident base can be, and that we're seeing as a possibility because of the courage of that man, courage of his family, and because of risking their future, He became a house husband and a writer on what he had designed, and he became a bestseller in Japan, not in the United States for some strange reason. But he told us about that, and we came down here and found some land, and a lot of things have happened in those 39 years. And it's been a big family, the same kind of family that the Aldrich family committed themselves to, and that's the story right there.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for all of your work and all of the family's work.
Amen to that, and a women too. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Gilberto Perez. I grew up in Spanish Harlem, in the Bronx, via Cuba. So I was born in Cuba, and somehow I ended up in the Bronx. No palm trees. Very rough. A lot of drugs, a lot of killings, heroin at the time. And in the late 70s, there was a lot of AIDS. How did I get here? To be a Buddhist. Before I was married, Sherna Goodman and Cheney were assassinated in Mississippi. These were college students and the Summer Freedom Rides, registering American blacks to vote. And of course, they were burning black churches at the time. Martin Luther King was preaching still, but he was there involved in Rosa Parks. After they found the bodies, I was in shock because they were mutilated. After the shock of that, it was almost an epiphany, Chris. So I went to church as a Catholic, and the priest never said a thing. So I had to question my religion. Why was they killing students for registering people of that, the right to vote? With deep questions at 19, I think I was. Then I got married, lived in the Bronx and Spanish Harlem and Harlem. And then I was involved with CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, in New York City. Then there was a big action at Columbia. They were going to make a gym there, which was Morningside Park, which is the only park in Harlem. And Columbia had a lot of property, subsidized housing, and they were finding ways to remove the elderly from all Section 8 housing, low-rent housing. So I got involved with that and Mark Rudd, who was there. And also John Kennedy had an effect on me, but not in 68 like Martin Luther King did. But earlier that was Malcolm X, another shock. Then in 68, Robert Kennedy, another shock. It wasn't just white boys going to find out who they were and why was I here, which was a theme then, you know, to find out who you are. So I had to figure out what was happening to America, and I decided to go to California. I had already a child. I excused my wife. I said, I don't know what's going on in this country. And I picked up a hitchhiker named Michael Schreiber, who had spent maybe a year as a conscientious objector. Sweet mensch from New York City, whose father was a dean of sociology at Hunter College. And he just got out. I says, okay, I'm picking you up. And I had my Volkswagen, little flowers in the back, a beard and an afro. He came in with his curly hair and a beard. And he wanted to see some professors in Chicago. I said, sure, why not? Let's go to Chicago first. Because I was going out to California. And he was a student at Berkeley, at Cal. When we ended in Chicago, it was the Chicago Convention. McGovern was a candidate. We were stopped by policemen with a thick Irish accent and with a lot of explicitives of, you have to get out of here. And a Volkswagen, I used to do mechanics in my own car. I had two bricks in my Volkswagen to put under the wheel so that when I changed the starter, it wouldn't back up on me. And he said, what are you doing? And I was so quick at the answers that he said, okay, get out of here. And another more explicitives. Michael said, no, I still want to see my professors. The University of Chicago, I waited for him about an hour. And then he said, why don't we just get out of this, all this noise and craziness? Why don't we go to Wyoming, the Great Tetons, and look at America? I said, sure, why not? So we camped out in Wyoming and got into Berkeley late August. And sure enough, I was tear gassed on the campus. Governor of California was Reagan, and he had brought policemen on the campus. I'm not afraid to say this, but one young man near Telegraph, he was on campus though, and he was using the large tape recorder which you carried on your shoulder with a big box, and he had a microphone. He put it to this cops who was, of course, saying all kinds of words about communism and all this other stuff, pinkos and radicals. And these are young kids. I mean, idealists. I'm from the hood. They're beating all these white kids up, too. And they beat this young man who went to record the voice of this policeman. They also had this black tape over their badge so you wouldn't report them. And as he hit him, this gush of blood popped out of him. And before Rodney King, three surrounded him and continued hitting him. And there was another concentric circle so that the students wouldn't come in. So in my basketball periphery seeing, I was looking one way and kicked a policeman where it hurts. I mean, I was really angry because these were young, sweet kids. I was 22 then, 23. I was an old man. I went into the cafeteria and started throwing dishes up and food, yelling to the students that your fellow students are getting beat up by the policemen. And they were yelling, why are you here eating? The history, your books, your history is right outside in front of the lunchroom here. I looked around campus for some rocks, the biggest I can find. It took me a while because there's just no campus rocks. A lot of eucalyptus trees. And I remember grabbing two rocks and throwing into the group of policemen. I was so angry. I wanted to choke a policeman. And that's, you know, my inner city reaction. You don't hit me. Anyway, Chris, I started crying. I think it was in front of Sproul Hall. And I remember a young man with a suit and tie tapped me on the shoulders. He said, are you okay? I said, yeah, I'm okay. I kept crying for a little while. I'm not used to crying. I was crying, Chris, not because I destroyed university property, not because I could have hurt a policeman, not because I hit the policeman, but because I became the policeman. It just shocked me. I was not a peace activist. I was not a peace activist. So I really seriously had to look at myself and what I had become at that moment. It shocked me. It scared me. So that I wasn't any different than that violent policeman. So since then, because I was a religion and philosophy student at San Francisco State, reading books on Thomas Merton, Socrates, and Plato, and truth. And then I read some books on Tibetans. Some Tibetans came to the college to chant. And I remember reading about a Hindu named Shivananda. Then I got into Gandhi and Vivekananda and Ramakrishna. And where all these saints. And also Alan Watts. Alan Watts had a meditation place in Berkeley. It was so quiet, I didn't go in there. But I went to see him at another place at Golden Gate Park. They had one of these something called beans. So there was dancing and music and people were painted their faces. So, you know, I kind of joined in and waiting for Alan Watts to come in with an entourage, and they had these prayer wheels. And he came on the stage, looked at us. He rang this gong, and the sound just vibrated through the hall, and he walked off the stage. That was it. I said, what happened? I thought I was going to hear something. Later on, I heard his lectures, and another who I went to listen to was Jay Krishnamurti in Ojai. And so all those things began my questioning of my purpose on this earth. Why am I here? What am I doing here? Places where I went with professors and others, I felt like a fly on a piece of cheesecake. I mean, there was all these white professors, Jewish brothers. There were no blacks, no Native Americans except Alcatraz, which were over in San Francisco trying to take over Alcatraz in 69. And I had two Native brothers in my apartment. I said, I really can't join you guys. I'm going to San Francisco State, and then there's stuff happening at Cal. I really don't have time. So I was involved in that and went to some Black Panther meetings. And that was pretty intense because they were already killing Black Panthers. So I just sensed, just street smarts, something's wrong here. So after a few meetings, I said, I don't belong here. Although in there were some good parts because I lived in the Haight for a while. And somebody said, there's music down the block, just two blocks. I said, I'm not ready for music. I found out 20 years later, Chris, that it was Jerry Garcia and the Deadheads doing music for free. Ever since then, you know, I went to see Ivan Illich in Cuernavaca, got lost, and ended up in Baja California. And fasting and I met this Italian who was down fishing from Chicago, taxi cab driver with his trailer. And he said, what are you doing? He says, I'm looking for God and searching for myself. Are you nuts? You're not going to find God. He says, stop this fasting. Come, let's go back home. And he convinced me. So he drove me back to the border, and I went back to my apartment in Berkeley. You know, my friend says, where was I for the last 2 months? Well, I was trying to see Ivan Illich in Cuernavaca. And students then were beat up by FBI or CIA for going down there. And I think he was even excommunicated from the church by then. So then it was liberation theology. Then I became a yoga instructor in New York City. Then I was ready to go to Canada. I was going to take my kids out of Harlem. But my French was not good enough because we were going to go to Montreal with my yoga teacher. My wife could speak French. We ended up in Maine. I was already working for a telephone company. Resumes from Canada all the way to New York. And that was the first resume after a year. It's a little town called Liberty. Quakers were up in Maine. And it was freedom, moral, union. And which town did I pick to live? Freedom, because it sounded nice. Freedom. That was liberating. And I just liked the maple tree that was in front of the house. It was on one of these old handyman specials. But I was willing to take almost 70% cut in pay. And all my kids have New England Hispanic twang now. And my son is now in Oakland working for the Union of Concerned Scientists. My daughter in Boston works for Ethel Kennedy in the Special Ed Foundation. Another daughter had worked for WGBH Boston. And the other daughter worked for the Democratic Legislature in Boston. So it's been a journey.
Gilberto, now you're sitting here today at Ground Zero. How did you get here?
Well, it's a good question because I've always been a radical in questioning since the 60s after the epiphany of Czerny Goodman and Czerny. I worked for the mayor of New York, but before that, the telephone company. I left the telephone company because I hired the first woman, and they didn't like that I hired the first woman. And I supported the workers as a management. They finally got a union. They were just treated awful because this grandpa and grandma company was taken over by a Continental Telephone Company, one of the third largest. And they were involved in some seedy stuff, not as bad as AT&T and Allende in Chile, but they were pretty crooked. From there, I got the job in New York City with the mayor, and again, Paola and Graff, and it was just too much for me. You know, I couldn't handle all this cheating. Then I even worked for the University of Massachusetts. And there I found out people were cheating the different departments and the provost. Again, opened my mouth. I was let go unceremoniously. They couldn't fire me, but they just didn't answer my calls or nobody spoke to me on campus because I raised some questions about missing monies. But in Amherst, when I was rewiring a network, fiber optics and coax cable for the new network at the campus, I would go to the 21st floor of the library. And I see a pagoda, and I bow. I would bow respectfully. And the 21st floor, I had all the books on philosophy and religion. I would go up there to read my books. And I went to the pagoda. I never saw a monk there. Later, they had a Cambodian temple there. So after ceremoniously being removed from the campus, I decided to go west on Route 2. And somehow I saw a pagoda sign and temple. Let me go meditate. And I went there, Chris, to sit down and meditate. And somebody says, there's a monk here. You want to meet him? I don't know. Sure, why not? And this monk came out and said, hi, how are you? I said, I'm fine. How are you? And he started talking about how the year before he did the Underground Railroad, he knew about Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass and Du Bois. And I could hear it, all this through a Japanese sound, you know. And he liked John Coltrane, and that he had just taken a break. He was on the Middle Passage Pilgrim's Walk to retrace the slave trade. Finally, I touched him and I said, what kind of monk are you? Well, he was Neponsa Myoji monk who do pilgrimages with Native Americans, Dennis Banks, Pelletier. One of the nuns was next door cell with Leland Pelletier, Junsan, the one I was here 40 years doing work with Dennis Banks and Peace Walks. I says, I know you like songs. He liked Paul Robeson's. I have 2 CDs of Paul Robeson in my vehicle. Would you like to listen to them? He says, I don't have, you know, he put his hands to his ears. I'll bring you a headset. Where will you be? Because I had, you know, the CD disc that you carry. Where will you be next week? He said, somewhere near Connecticut, on the border with Massachusetts. I'll meet you there. He was surprised that I came and gave him the headset. When I saw this motley crew of peace activists, Native Americans, blacks, gays, elderly, young, I was curious. So I joined them. You know, I had 6 months to find a job because I can get unemployment for 6 months. I ended up walking with them to New Orleans. In the meantime, we met Alice Walker, saw Nat King Cole's piano, and then met Desmond Tutu in Emory College. He was doing lectures there. So that was enough to convince me, this is an interesting group. I later found work in the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, again doing networks and so forth. And Shoni, Kanaita Shoni, who's the head monk at Bainbridge, was there at the, I says, I'll come and join your walk for a little bit. Well, I can get off a few days. I forget what year was that, maybe 2000 or something like that. The following year or so, he says, I'm coming to Bainbridge Island. Would you like to come? Sure, why not? Because he was going to get his green card. I could help him with his green card. And within a month of him telling me that he was coming, I followed him here. And within a few years, I became a monk with Nippon Zanmi Hoji. I have more stories, but I think that's enough.
That's a journey.
Yes. Chris, I expected that we were going to have love and peace in the 60s. Well, I was wrong. We lost. And then there was, again, the search, how do I go back to the greening of America? How do I grow my own food? How do I take care of my children? How do I bring them up as responsible citizens? That became, as a father, my goal. And after they were grown, out of college, I said, okay, I'm going back to seek God, and which is not about hope and waiting for something to happen, but you have to be involved in action, willing to be getting arrested and so forth.
The journey to become a monk here on Bainbridge, how long did that take? Or is it measurable?
Well, it was measurable in the characters of the monk, the discipline, their silence in doing things without explaining too much. They're not linear. It's just action. Whether it's nailing a nail on the roof and shingles or digging a hole for vegetables. It was just very quietly, almost in a Zen manner. And that was very refreshing. And I liked the idea of not having to explain a lot of things, that you do it because you felt it in your heart. And that was a main reason for coming.
And here you are.
And here I am. And if it wasn't for all these good people that we saw today at Ground Zero, pro bono lawyers, Daniel Barragan, Steve Kelly, Father Bix, who to me were like light, you know, who were Jesus-like or Buddha-like. And there was no, if you're into Judaism, they were Baal Shem Tovs. They were dancing. They were just joy in life. And it meant something. There's no words for what you feel inside. In this school, it's a chant. Like in St. John, in the beginning was the word. The word, what is the word? Well, I'll teach you, monk says, Nam-myo Renge Kyo.
Ring the gong.
Ring the gong, yes.
Thank you, Roberto.
You're welcome, Chris.
This week's Compass was written and produced by Chris Bricker. The Compass airs Saturday at noon and repeats the following Monday at noon and 5 p.m. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream live 24 hours a day. Executive producer for Compass is Steve Evans. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, this is Chris Bricker.